This is episode 478. Did you know that plant foods that you probably ate yesterday are apparently full of toxins that are poisonous and we should avoid them at all costs? That's the message that I thought I knew from Dr. Stephen Gundry, the famous heart surgeon and four-time best-selling author, who's been telling people for years to avoid beans, lentils, and vegetables that contain lectins and other compounds for years. I came into this conversation ready to debate him because honestly, I felt like he was misleading millions of people through one of the world's biggest health podcasts and all of his content. But what we discussed is absolutely not what I expected. A couple of topics, it was actually the opposite of what I thought he was all about. It turns out some very important details about his work have been missed, misunderstood, and misrepresented by people creating social media beef for likes and followers. Now, do I agree with all of his advice after this chat? No, not necessarily. But I was refreshed to hear him clarify some very important nuances that I think millions of people have completely missed. So without further ado, we really need to get into unpacking and demystifying what is actually going on here. So let's dive in. Even as a scientist and nutritionist, I was secretly trapped in binge eating and hooked on sugar. And let's be real, the so-called solutions can feel overwhelming. Calorie counting, restrictive diets, weight loss pills, surgery, and even injections. I'm Maddie Lansdowne, and the truth is, more nutrition facts aren't the answer. It's understanding why we eat the way we do. And you don't need to be perfect to achieve great health either. That shift changed everything for me, and now I share it here as the host of the Real Weight Loss Coach podcast, where it's my mission to help 1 million people break free from the yo-yo diet cycle for good, by bringing you the conversations that really matter in nutrition, health, and psychology. And I'm not afraid to challenge mainstream health advice when it doesn't stack up. Are you ready? Let's begin. What's up, my healthy friends? This episode here is going to be a juicy one, so stick around to the end because we've got some very good conversation coming. First thing though, this year it's my mission to support 500 people to achieve real weight loss. And by real, I mean dealing with what's really weighing you down and not just the number on the scale. Links to discuss how we help people with weight loss and emotional and binge eating are down below. And by the way, we do that quite successfully without calorie counting, getting you to do weight check-ins, or without hardcore rules around forbidden foods. And how do we do that? Because it sounds a little bit like a, whoa, that sounds too good to be true. Well, to find out, the links to inquire are down in the show notes below or the caption below. So scroll down, click, have a conversation, and we'll see if we can support you. So today's little chit chat, I'm joined by the famous Dr. Stephen Gundry, a former renowned heart surgeon, professor, and chairman of cardiothoracic surgery at Loma Linda University, who's now become a New York Times best-selling author with his theories and his book series about lectins and gut health. You might remember his book that went super viral that sort of put him on the map in my world over here in Australia called The Plant Paradox. And now his new book, The Gut-Brain Paradox, which I've got here on screen if you're on video anywhere, explores how our gut bacteria might be controlling our thoughts and our cravings. Stephen's work has sparked significant debate in the medical and nutrition community, of which I'm eager to get into myself because I also have many questions, which is, I guess, probably why I'm a podcast host. But anyway, the man himself, Dr. Stephen Gundry, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
No worries. It's really exciting to have you here. I've seen you on Reels and on YouTube and on podcasts for years now, so it's pretty amazing that I'm sitting here with you.
And here we are, but through the magic of the internet.
Yeah, it's wild, actually, the journey of being a podcaster, how many incredibly sort of high-level, influential people that it's connected me to and that I have regular conversations with. It's sort of like I have these moments, imposter syndrome moments of like, how did I end up in the room with these people?
What am I doing in the room with me? That's what I want to know.
So I got a question for you to maybe go back to the origin story a little bit. So if we could travel back in time for a moment where, let's say, you're in the world of surgery, you're elbow deep in somebody's chest doing heart surgery, and I just sort of whisper in your ear and say, one day you're going to be telling people to avoid tomatoes and beans. What do you think past surgeon Stephen would have said to future Stephen or current Stephen?
Well, past surgeon Steve would say, well, This was actually your thesis as an undergraduate at Yale University of what ancient man ate to turn a great ape into a human being. And that was actually my thesis that I defended and got an honors for. And I gave it to my parents. I went away to become a famous heart surgeon. And lo and behold, almost 30 years ago now, I was confronted with a guy who I call Big Ed, who was a 48-year-old gentleman from Miami, Florida, with inoperable coronary artery disease. And by that, we mean you couldn't put stents because everything was clogged up. You couldn't do bypass surgery because there wasn't any place to land a bypass. And like so many people with this condition, Big Ed would go around to various centers in the United States looking for idiot surgeons like myself who would take on a daunting task. And everywhere he went, he was turned down. And I was one of those people who would take these people on. And so after about 6 months of doing this, Big Ed winds up in my office with his angiogram from Miami of 6 months ago. And I looked at his angiogram and I said, you know, I got to agree with everybody else. I can't help you. They're right. There's just, I'd love to help you, but there's nothing here. He says, yeah, everybody says that. But let me tell you what I've been doing. I've been going around the country for 6 months. I put myself on a diet and I went to a health food store and I've been taking a lot of supplements. He literally brought in a giant shopping bag full of supplements. And he said, I've lost 45 pounds in 6 months. Now, this guy weighed 265 when I met him. So, Big Ed. And he says, you know, maybe I did something in here. And I, you know, scratching my beard and going, well, you know, good for you, Big Ed, for losing weight, but that's not going to do anything in there. And I know what you did with all your supplements. You made expensive urine, which is, I firmly believe. And yeah, I said, you wasted your money. He said, well, look, I've come all this way from Miami. What would it hurt to get another angiogram, another cardiac catheterization? I said, don't get your hopes up, but okay. So we get a new angiogram. And this guy, in 6 months' time, has cleaned out 50% of the blockages in his coronary arteries. I mean, they're gone. Now, if I knew what I knew now, I'd say, hey, you know, great going. You're doing exactly right. You know, have a nice life. But I didn't know that. So I said, great news. You know, now there's places to do bypasses. And we did a five-vessel bypass on him and it went fine. And afterwards, I said, you know, I've never seen anything like this ever. And it's impossible. What? Tell me about this diet you were on. So he starts rattling off what he had been eating. And I go, hold on. That's my thesis from Yale University about what ancient man ate. And you know, how'd you know all that? And he said, well, I just kind of made it up. And I said, let me look at those supplements. Now, I was very famous for keeping hearts alive during heart surgery and heart transplants by putting this bunch of crud down the arteries and veins to protect the heart cells from not dying. And I'm pulling out his supplements, and I don't know, half of them I was dissolving in the solution and putting it down the arteries and veins. It never occurred to me to swallow the dumb stuff. So just kind of, you know, overnight seeing something that was impossible, and then having him tell me that literally my thesis was what he was on, and then seeing that the stuff I was using to keep heart cells alive, he was swallowing, that there I was. My ancient person was saying, see, you know, you should have done this in the first place. So I was my guinea pig. Even though I was a famous heart surgeon, I was 70 pounds overweight. I was running 30 miles a week, going to the gym 1 hour a day, eating a healthy, low-fat, mostly vegetarian diet. And I had migraine headaches when I operated. I had such bad arthritis in my knees, I wore braces to run. I had high blood pressure, pre-diabetes, high cholesterol. And within literally 3 months, all of these things went away. And so I lost 50 pounds my first year and another 20, and I've kept it off for 25 years now. So I started the people I operated on, I started them on this program, and I'd send them to a health food store and say, you know, go buy these supplements. And because I don't want to operate on you again. Most people are back 5 to 7 years after a stent or a bypass and get a new one. And lo and behold, these people would come back and their blood pressure would be normal, and we'd be taking them off their blood pressure medicines, and their diabetes would go away, and we'd have to take them off their diabetes meds, and their arthritis would resolve. And I go, after a year of doing this at Loma Linda, I literally looked in the mirror on Friday morning on the way to work, and I said, you know, I've got this all wrong. I shouldn't operate on people and then teach them how to stay away from me afterwards. I should teach them how to eat first, and they'll never need me to operate on them. Now, that's a really stupid thing to do at the height of your career as a heart surgeon. But literally, at the height of I resigned my position and headed just down the road from Loma Linda to Palm Springs and set up a clinic. And because I'm a researcher, I said, hey, you know, here's some foods I want you to eat. Here's some foods I don't want you to eat. Go to a health food store. I want you to buy these supplements. We're going to check your blood every 3 months, and we're going to see what happens, okay? And insurance will pay for it. And so that's how we started doing this. And then I started publishing my results at the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology. And eventually, after about 17 years of this, I published The Plant Paradox. And you're right, that became a monster bestseller around the world, 36 foreign languages. And anyhow, so that's how all this got started. Big Ed.
Yeah, right. And at the time, did, I guess, any of your medical or surgical colleagues think you were a bit wild or a bit outlandish to be talking about this? Because my experience of working in a hospital and then leaving definitely got me branded as a bit of a hippie or a quack or a, you know, that's medicine's the best thing that's ever existed. So why would you go to food kind of thing? Did you have any of those experiences?
Well, one of the things I wanted to do, again, because my background is academic, you know, research, I had a lab and the whole bit, was I was going to not give talks at fringe meetings. I was going to show my stuff at, you know, the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology and the European Heart Association and so on. And I wanted to have my academic peers assess my work rather than, you know, labeling it a pseudoscience or whatever. And so I did that on purpose. And I think it stood me well because I was able to publish my results in journals. And so that's why I did it the way I did it.
I'm curious, go on.
And it's interesting. A lot of my colleagues still will come to see me and say, make sure no one knows I'm seeing you because I don't want the word to get out, but, you know, help me out, would you?
I had some of those experiences as well, even when I started the podcast, still working in hospitals and, you know, in cancer research, and people after meetings would sort of come over secretly and be like, so I've been listening to your podcast. They're like, oh, I think this is interesting. This is some interesting ideas. And it was like a bit of a pseudo or like private embarrassed kind of moment for people to admit that they were listening.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm curious, because one of the challenges that I see when it comes to maybe the broader conversation around holistic health or food as medicine or anything like that is that it's quite difficult to get into, mainstream or conventionally accepted medical organizations to promote these ideas. And the subtext of what I'm saying is that because these are not pharmaceutically driven ideas, it seems like the public are challenged by accepting this information from any alternative. So how did you manage to get into these spaces? Is it because, like, in order to get into these spaces to speak about this stuff, like the American Heart Association, does everybody, all of us need to become a famous heart surgeon to have our voice heard?
No, but it certainly helps because, I mean, for instance, I was the president of the Southern California chapter of the American Heart Association for 2 years, and I was on the program committees for the American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology. So I guess, you know, I had the academic cred that, well, you know, when I would submit a paper for presentation, that at least they didn't say, you know, this is hogwash. Oh, that's Dr. Gundry, you know, sending this in. And maybe we should at least give him a hearing, I guess, is a nice way to put it. Well, I think that way. And again, I did that on purpose because I really did want mainstream consideration for what sounds really pseudoscience and woo-woo, right?
Well, I mean, for myself, like I definitely have this experience of working in the nutrition or the naturopathy space and surrounded by all sorts of holistic practitioners, including many people that were once medical doctors. And it seems that there's a very obvious agenda to silence a lot of those alternatives. And most of us are able to solve problems that the doctors could have solved if they weren't handcuffed by the medical system or the pharmaceutical system. Like in Australia, it's difficult for doctors to even order, you know, certain tests before they get a phone call that says, hey, why are you ordering so many vitamin D tests? Like, that's a bit odd, you know? And it's like, so it feels like, oh, what is the key combination to getting, to infiltrating these organizations that control our medical world? Because we obviously live in countries that are fat, sick, and dying. So something went catastrophically wrong in the last 50 years.
Yeah, you know, you bring up a very good point. I like to try to think I listen to my patients. In fact, several of my books I dedicate to my patients because most of the stuff I've done, I've learned from them either as being guinea pigs for me or they've taught me something. And since you brought up vitamin D, I think it's well worth talking about. Number of years ago, probably 20 years ago, I was seeing two new patients in their late 70s, husband and wife. And we measure vitamin D levels on everybody every 3 months. And they were sitting across from me and I had their labs and their vitamin D levels in nanograms per milliliter units, which we use here, were 178. Now, I was taught that 80 and above is probably toxic. So I'm looking at them and they seem perfectly normal. And I'm looking at their vitamin D level and I go, you guys take a lot of vitamin D, don't you? And they said, oh, yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, it's a longevity vitamin. Really? Yeah, right. And so I'm looking at their calcium, and their calciums are perfectly normal. And I'm looking at their kidney function. It's perfectly normal. And I'm going, you know, any kidney stones? No. Why? I said, and one of the other theories of vitamin D toxicity is you might get some numbness in your fingers and toes and moans, groans, and I go, you know, anything like that? They said, no. And they said, why do you keep asking about this? I said, well, quite frankly, from what I've been taught, you should be dead. And they said, you don't know much about vitamin D, do you, Sonny? It was literally Sonny. And I said, well, what I've been taught. And they said, you know, maybe you ought to read about it. And I took them up. And lo and behold, I was taught completely wrong. And in autoimmune disease, which 80% of my patients now are autoimmune patients who aren't getting any better. And just invariably, these people have very low vitamin D levels. And I'll push them up. I run my patients from 100 to 150, but I'll give you a great example. Just my last patient is a woman who just had horrible fibromyalgia and tendonitis, literally couldn't move. A young woman, 46 years old, and really low vitamin D levels, positive for anti-nuclear antibody, positive for double-stranded DNA. I could go on and on. And we pushed her vitamin D levels up to about 117. And long story short, her, all of these issues resolved. And she's also seen by a major medical center in Northern California. And she was running a vitamin D level of 115. And they said, oh my gosh, you're vitamin D toxic. You know, you can't do this. This was on 15,000 international units of vitamin D3 a day. And she said, no, I'm being followed by somebody in Southern California. So, well, be careful. So I just saw her, and her vitamin D level was 171. And there she is smiling at me. Her calcium is 10.1, perfectly normal. Her kidney function's unbelievable. I said, you've been pushing your vitamin D, haven't you? She said, yeah, you know, I felt I was already getting sick, so I was taking 50,000 international units every day for the last 3 months. And I said, you're a perfect example. There you are, 50,000 international units a day, and you're only at 171, and you're not dead. And so, and she says, yeah, I feel pretty good. And she said, you're going to make me stop it, aren't you? I said, I'm not going to make you stop it. You're fine. You know, if you want to keep doing that, it's fine with me. She said, but what's San Francisco going to say? I said, whatever they want to say.
Yeah, wow, that's incredible. I've definitely had plenty of experience with vitamin D as well. And yeah, the idea that there's a toxicity. I mean, I understand that we've got to put something in place for safety measures because there is an unknown, but it's still unknown to me where that line is as well. Because yeah, whether it be cancer patients or diabetics or, you know, even just the average person who spends all day inside or when they are outside, they're fully clothed.
You guys in, you know, Australia and Southern California think we shouldn't go outside with in a full burqa, right? With smear sunscreen on in case anything gets through. And it's like, yeah. And 80% of my patients in Southern California are vitamin D deficient. I mean, below 30, walking through the door. Yeah. But you're right. There, the University of California, San Diego, which has a huge vitamin D research unit, has not seen vitamin D toxicity at 40,000 international units a day. And I haven't either.
Yeah, well, that's incredible. I mean, and good for people to hear, too, I think, that are supplementing or thinking. Because I think the recommendation, if I'm going back to uni days and I haven't recommended the recommended daily dose in a long time, I think it's about 400 international units a day. I think a lot of people that supplement or buy their supplements from, you know, chemists or drugstores or supermarkets with these super low doses are like, oh, no wonder I'm not getting better. It's not enough.
Yeah. No, that's right. That's not right.
So I'm curious to talk about your book, I guess, and the brain paradox, the gut brain paradox. And essentially, I guess my interpretation, you know, my general overarching interpretation of what you were sharing in that book was sort of saying our gut bacteria are like puppet masters in a way, controlling our thoughts and our cravings. And I'm curious about your take on this because it kind of sounds like a combination of liberating and terrifying. Liberating because it's not our fault, so to speak, but terrifying because it suggests that we're not even really in control when we're eating what we think are healthy foods. So how do you navigate that space psychologically?
Yeah, that's what's interesting. Again, a reason I wrote this book is a lot of my patients, I do deal with a lot of addictive personalities and addictions. I deal with a lot of patients, particularly women who are on 1, 2, or 3 antidepressants and have been for many, many years. And one of the things that has occurred over the passage of time, and, you know, I've been seeing patients in this role for 25 years now, is that invariably, as we change their gut microbiome, and now there are pretty doggone good tests for looking at the microbiome, thanks to the Human Microbiome Project, we can know who's in there, and it gets more interesting with every day, and what those bugs are doing in a positive or negative way. And we're beginning to see bacteria that are associated with behaviors. And so many of my patients, let's just take autoimmune disease, let's take depression, they would gradually wean themselves off their antidepressants as time went on because they always wanted to be off of them, but usually couldn't. And, you know, they'd come in sheepishly and say, don't get mad at me, but, you know, I stopped my two antidepressants. And I said, I'm not mad at you. That was, you know, part of what we hoped would happen. And one of the things that was really enlightening, and I think I wrote about it a couple books ago, but SSRIs, most of the antidepressants are serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And if they really worked by inhibiting serotonin uptake, then you and I could swallow a Prozac and tomorrow we'd be deliriously happy because our brains would just, you know, be flooded with serotonin. And of course, that doesn't happen. It can take a month or more to kick in. And then the research started showing up that, number one, we know that the tryptophan pathway bacteria that make serotonin are killed off by Roundup, by glyphosate, which unfortunately is in everything in the United States, and I suspect Australia, certainly. And that glyphosate kills off the tryptophan pathway bacteria, and I mean, selectively. So what's cool about these serotonin reuptake inhibitors, if you follow people's microbiome, they actually change the microbiome, and it takes months to actually change the microbiome to a more favorable tryptophan serotonin producing microbiome. It's like, son of a gun, these drugs aren't working in the brain. They're actually working down in the gut. And it's the products of the gut bacteria that are actually having the favorable effect. And that was just one of the many clues that maybe we're looking in the wrong place. And on a more philosophical level, bacteria have been around for 3 billion years. Mm-hmm. And they're pretty good at what they do. And there are those of us who, in secret, really think that much of the reason we're here is just for bacteria to have a lovely place to live and bacteria to guide us in choices that are mutually beneficial if you had the right set of bacteria. And as long as you're around, that's a wonderful home, as long as you do their bidding. Now, unfortunately, most of us no longer have a great set of bacteria, as I and others have talked about for almost 10 years now. And a bunch of bad guys have pretty much taken over and are directing us to get them what they want. And so I'll stop there for a moment and let that sink in.
Loving what you're hearing? Make sure you're subscribed here on your favorite podcast app. Or there's even more waiting for you over on YouTube. On our channel, you'll get to see our fascinating guests demonstrate their techniques in real time. You'll see my animated explanation of complex health concepts made simple, plus all of those you had to be there moments that we mentioned in the show. The Coaching with Maddie episodes will be there too. We're also creating exclusive YouTube shorts, quick, powerful health tips you won't find anywhere else. And let's face it, if we're going to be doom scrolling, which we all do from time to time, you might as well make it worthwhile. Just search How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast on YouTube and hit subscribe to unlock the visual side of becoming a healthy friend of the show. Because sometimes you need to see it to believe it and also to achieve it. The direct link is in the show notes below. Come and join our YouTube community. Yeah, so I guess what I'm taking from that is the, you know, the glyphosate, the chemicals, the things that are added to our foods are a big part of the problem that's disrupting our microbiome. But where does that tie in with, because a big part of your message, as I understand it, is that we should be avoiding lectin foods because lectins themselves are dangerous. So is it the lectin in the food, which is naturally occurring, or is it the chemical or the genetic modification that is the problem?
Well, I think half of the plant paradox is the seven deadly disruptors. And normally, I mean, plants and their predators and animals are plant predators. Plants had it great before animals arrived. Nobody wanted to eat them. Mm-hmm. And when animals arrived and insects were the first, plants couldn't run, they couldn't hide, they couldn't fight, but they're chemists of incredible ability. as anyone who uses psychedelics would tell you, to use that for that purpose as well. But so we used to have an amazing defense system against these defensive compounds that plants would make to prevent us from eating them. And we had a great set of microbiomes. There are microbes that love to eat gluten, for instance. There are microbes that will be more than happy to munch on lectins. They'll be more than happy to munch on phytates. Phytates can be turned into short-chain fatty acids, believe it or not, if you have the right microbiome. Normally, we should have a microbiome that eats oxalate and completely diffuses it because they like to eat it. The problem is because of broad-spectrum antibiotics, because of glyphosate, most of us are walking around with, you know, a desert wasteland for a microbiome instead of a tropical rainforest. And I think that message, even to this day, was missed in the plant paradox. If we had what we used to have, then we could eat these things because we had an amazing defense system against these things. The point is, we don't. And so we've been set wide open for these plant defensive compounds. And so because the Human Microbiome Project was only completed in 2017 when my book was published, we now know that there's two things. Number one, we have incredible gut dysbiosis. We wiped out most of the good guys and there's mostly bad guys. And we now have a gut wall that's permeable, among other reasons, because of lectins, because of NSAIDs, because of acid-reducing drugs. So we can go on and on. So you've got to have a leaky gut. And it's a real thing, folks. We can measure it. We can do blood tests. We can watch it occur. We can watch it go away. I've done it on myself. But we can also rebuild the gut microbiome. Is it a big project? Yes, it is. The husband and wife microbiology team at Stanford, the Sonnenbergs, I think are the kind of the doomsayers of rebuilding the microbiome. They think it's probably hopeless. I don't think it's hopeless. I've seen it done. I do it in my patients. Is it a time-consuming process? Yes. I mean, I used to think when I started that I could see a leaky gut in a couple of weeks. It takes most people 9 months to a year. Some people it takes 2, 3, 4 years to rebuild all this. But it can be done. That's what's exciting.
Yeah, I definitely share that belief that it can be done. And I've definitely seen many clients with gut issues, and whether it be brain fog, blood sugar stuff, whether it be, you know, constipation, diarrhea, pain when eating, resolved by introducing diversity of food and also very intentionally introducing fermented food so that we're really injecting, you know, living bacteria, not just a probiotic that's, you know, snap frozen, like, you know, real living sauerkraut, you know, that kind of thing into guts. And I've seen it be so incredibly beneficial hundreds and hundreds of times.
Yeah. And the thing I wrote about in the last book, Gut Check, which I think was an eye opener for me, is, for instance, there's one of the keystone species in the gut is Akkermansia eosinophila. And there, it took a company in the United States 10 years, Pendulum Life, to actually produce human living Akkermansia that could survive gastric digestion. And they've done a wonderful job, except that it turns out that dead Akkermansia will do the exact same thing. And so, yeah. And so what I proposed in another one of my books, The Energy Paradox, is that the expression dead men tell no tales may be true, but dead bacteria do tell tales, because bacteria actually read the barcode on the cell wall of any bacteria to identify who that is. Bacteria see. They can count the number of bacteria, quorum sensing. And they read what I call the barcode and know who's there. And what we now know is that it's not the living probiotics that are very important. It's the messages that are now called postbiotics of dead bacteria and the compounds that they made during the fermentation process, which is postbiotics, primarily short-chain fatty acids, that make all the difference. And that's actually really exciting. So you don't, in my humble opinion, need to fret about, yeah, do you want fermented foods? Absolutely. My last three books, please get fermented foods. But you don't necessarily have to have living probiotics. You can get the products of fermentation and do really great. Because, again, dead bacteria tell lots of tales.
That's super.
And we should have been aware of that because LPSs, lipopolysaccharides, are merely the cell wall of gram-negative bacteria. And they get through the wall of the gut, either through leaky gut or riding on fats. And our immune system believes them to be living bacteria because they're reading the wall of that bacteria, the barcode, and say, oh my gosh, you know, there's living bacteria, you know, attacking us. And this can be done in human experiments. In fact, the Iceman, Wim Hof, became infamous or famous by using his breathing techniques, injecting himself or having scientists inject him with LPSs, which are dead bacteria. And normally he should go into septic shock. We can do this with healthy volunteers. They'll go into septic shock as if they were injected with live bacteria. And he just sits there and laughs. And he trained 20 of his disciples to do the same thing. And they all got injected with LPSs. And they all said, yeah, so what? So this is information. And the information that occurs is at such subtle levels. It's just do. I spent a chapter in the gut brain paradox talking about these little text messages that bacteria are able to send out that contain RNA, contain DNA, contain living mitochondria that can pass through gut wall, cell walls, bloodstream, blood-brain barrier, and then deliver that text message through a cell membrane and change the epigenetic code of the DNA expression. And plants can do the same thing. They've had 3 billion years to figure this out. And again, it sounds really woo-woo, but now we're understanding how just deeply involved these ecosystems are. And I sit back and I go, how did Hippocrates know this 2,500 years ago when, you know, all disease begins in the gut? And all disease ends in the gut. Everybody goes, oh, yeah. They had leeches and they had black bile. Everything that we've learned now since the Human Microbiome Project, really, the guy was right.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's incredible that we look back in time, and whether it be through Chinese medical stuff that's been going on for thousands of years or Ayurveda, sure, they didn't have 100% of things figured out, but there's a lot that they had figured out to extreme detail.
Yeah, I've got one of my patients is a Buddhist scholar, and he knows Sanskrit really well, and we were talking about this one day. He says, you know, that sounds familiar. He says, I'm going to look into this. And so he texted me. He says, you're not going to believe this. The Buddha, who was actually a contemporary of Hippocrates, same time period, said that enlightenment comes from the intestines. I went, you know, how do these guys know this stuff? isn't that cool?
Oh, it's incredible. But I think, I just want to go back to something you mentioned before that you said you felt was missed in the plant paradox, because, and I would agree based on what you've just shared with me, that it was definitely missed, because I guess everybody maybe not everybody, but a lot of people in the space of health and wellness know you as the guy that's like, avoid nightshades, avoid lectins, they're bad, they're toxic, they're get away from them, they cause disease. But you've just said that you feel like it was missed, that if you have the right gut bacteria, that's actually not the case. Am I interpreting that correctly?
That's correct. For instance, you know, when you look at super old people, number one, we're talking about 105-year-old people who are doing well. These guys have a gut microbiome that actually resembles a 30-year-old. And number two, they have a gut microbiome that are capable of eating what are called xenobiotics. For instance, plastics. They're capable of eating plastics. And people go, wait a minute, bacteria can't eat plastic. Plastic are carbon atoms. And they're petroleum-based. And we now know that we can engineer bacteria that'll eat oil slicks. Good idea. Because all they're looking for is carbon atoms. So these guys actually have bacteria that can break down plastic. And what a great idea. We don't have them anymore. So you start kind of looking at how these guys got to where they are. And it's because they have this incredibly robust, diverse microbiome.
Yeah, it makes so much more sense to hear you say that, because I was definitely in the camp of thinking, like, how can we be avoiding all of these foods? And like, for instance, I've had Karen Hurd on the podcast. I'm not sure if you know her, but she's a biochemist over in the USA that's basically the lectin or the lentil and bean woman that talks about their detoxification purposes. And even my partner Yali is Sri Lankan, born and raised in Paris, but Sri Lankan, and still grew up on, you know, lots of curries, and our house has lots of beans and lentils as a result of that. And she's a picture of health, had a totally drug-free home birth, healed very quickly. And so it was interesting me coming into this conversation thinking, like, I've got a lot of evidence to debate that lectins are bad, but it's so refreshing to hear you clarify that. I feel like we need to write a book on just that so everybody can reinterpret what you meant.
But you got to also understand that most cultures that eat lectin-rich food have figured out a way to detoxify those lectins. Mm-hmm. Usually, and people talk about soaking. Well, if you've ever put beans in water, within a few hours, you get this scum on the top. Well, that scum is actually fermentation. All plants have their own microbiome, including beans. So the beans are fermented, and that's what the soaking does. And so, for instance, corn, Central American Indians and the Mexican Indians who made corn, always boiled corn in lime juice or put lye in it to take the hull off of corn and to keep corn from binding niacin. And it became hominy or pozole, and then they would grind it up into hominy grits, and they would not eat corn or make a corn tortilla without doing that. In fact, masa harina flour is how normally corn tortillas are made. And it's like, you know, when Columbus brought the Southwest American Indians, who used peppers as their food, always charred, peeled the peppers, and deseeded them before they ate them. The Italians would not eat tomatoes for 200 years after their native son Columbus brought them back, because they knew how dangerous they were. And to this day, in Italy, you can't make tomato sauce without peeling and deseeding the tomatoes. Interestingly enough, you will never see a jar of Italian red peppers with peels and seeds in them. They're gone, because these cultures have figured it out. The Incas rotted quinoa, fermented it, and then they cooked it. And it's not on the package directions. I mean, 4 billion people go to the trouble of taking the hull off of brown rice and making it white before they eat it. I mean, why do they do that? That's a lot of work if brown rice is so good for you. So all of these cultures, and that's what I do. I go around the world and figure out, okay, how did these guys figure this out? And they had figured it out. And of course, all bread was fermented. We didn't, yeah. You know, why did they do that? And there's actually a good argument that can be read that the agricultural revolution was not to make bread, it was to make beer, but that's another subject.
Yeah, that's. I think that you bring up something really important, which maybe is a more helpful message, because something that I see with a lot of the people that I work with is that they have this food fear because they know they've identified that ultra-processed food is bad. They're getting that message loud and clear. And then they're in this space and, you know, I run a health business as well and I understand marketing, and the nature of marketing, especially in our world, is that divisive gets more clicks, more likes, more attention. And so we've got these people that are super confused. And so I feel like a more helpful message would probably be that we can actually have companion or complementary foods that facilitate, one, microbiome diversity increase, and two, the detoxification of foods that are actually, or molecules that are harmful in high amounts. Because I'm sure, like you've just described, all of these people over hundreds or thousands of years figured out what works with what, rather than it's just be scared of everything and then take a supplement that came out of a man-made factory.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, for instance, you know, I usually have beans twice a week. Are they soaked and pressure cooked? Yes. And I even got a very famous vegan physician here in the United States to admit on my podcast that he pressure cooks his beans and wouldn't think of eating beans unpressure cooked. And I went, why don't you tell people that? You know, it's like, come on. Or, yeah. You know, or just, you know, in Tuscany, where beans are, you know, really one of the big foods, they soak their beans for 48 hours and they ferment them. And they're smart. They figured out how to do it.
And yeah, we have part of our list of regular snacks in this house is that hummus gets made. And it always, the chickpeas are always soaked, but a little bit of bicarb soda also helps extract all of that stuff that causes discomfort and that kind of thing. But interesting is that recently we noticed we had a period of time where we sort of just, you know, we've got a newborn baby here, so life's a bit hectic, but we didn't have the usual sort of curries and lentils and that kind of thing. And day one of eating them, we both had a bit of gas, a bit going on in our guts. But by day two, it's like we were back to normal. So our gut had re-regulated or figured that out again. So it was useful to sort of, an N equals two in our house kind of scenario to be like, oh, we took a little bit of a break and the body took a day to adjust back to what we do normally.
Yeah. And we know that you can really, in 3 days, fairly dramatically change the microbiome characteristics of, you know, who wants to eat what and who, you know, who's higher on the food chain, so to speak. But
yeah. And with this, with your book, The Gut-Brain Connection, and this conversation about lectins, what is it specifically or particularly that is causing this brain fog or brain inflammation? Like, what messages are being sent from the gut to the brain and or the foods that are going through the leaky gut scenario that most people have got that end up giving people this, you know, foggy brain, let's call it?
Yeah, so, you know, 80% of all of our immune cells, our white blood cells, line the gut. Why are they there? Because that's where mischief is going to come across, and that's where our troops should be located. They normally, you can get break through the wall of the gut and stomp out that little invasion fairly quickly. But now we don't have a defense against breaking through the wall of the gut. So it's literally a constant battle. And our forward troops basically talk to their counterparts in the brain, the microglial cells, which are the immune system of the brain. And they're basically send text messages, cytokines, and also via the vagus nerve, and say, we can't hold the line down here anymore. They're getting past us. They're coming for you. Prepare yourselves. Start protecting the neurons up there. And what happens, and we can measure this, is you can actually watch these microglial cells start eating these dendritic processes of the neurons, trying to protect the neurons, kind of calling everybody back to the castle and then lifting up the drawbridge over the moat. simplistically. And so that's neuroinflammation. And what's exciting, and we can measure leaky gut, and we can measure leaky brain, we can measure microglial activation. And when we heal leaky gut, we can watch the leaky brain stop. We can watch the microglial activation stop. And that correlates with people going, oh, yeah, my brain fog's gone. And so again, what we used to think of as pseudoscience, we now, thanks to pretty cool research, can see how this is happening. And, like people say, well, I eat an anti-inflammatory diet. So inflammation, it comes from leaky gut. That's where it came from. That's where, and in Southern California, and I know what happens in Australia, trying to fight a forest fire by eating anti-inflammatory foods is like trying to put out a forest fire with a garden hose. And we know how well that works. And so, and it's the same way. So I can heal somebody's leaky gut. Somebody can heal their leaky gut. But as I tell people, look, if you keep swallowing razor blades, and I'll just call lectins razor blades or oxalates razor blades, then you'll tear it right back open. So until you get a really good microbiome, until you build it to what it used to be, and I think it's possible, the Sonnenbergs don't think so, then you got to be careful. For instance, we were just talking about this with one of my patients 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, 10 years ago, I'd go to Italy and again, I go eat all this food. I would have to take one of my products, and this is not a commercial for my products, but Lectin Shield, which absorbs lectins. There are sugar molecules that absorb lectins. I would have to take 10 of these capsules a day to do what I needed to do, or otherwise I'd bloat and I'd have issues. I don't have to take any anymore. I can go over there and I'm just fine. Why? Because I'm had 10 years of rebuilding my defense team. So that's just an N of one. But yeah, we're just wide open for these attacks that would have never happened 50 years ago.
Yeah. It's
50 years now since broad spectrum antibiotics were introduced and glyphosate was introduced. 50 years.
Yeah. That's by definition, two generations worth of people that have been born into a world with both of those things. Yeah. Plus add in the sugar avalanche that's happened in that time as well. And yeah, it's like, and I guess when it comes to the USA and Australia, the lack of regulation around what goes into foods and how they're marketed, and it's a mess. It's a metabolic mess.
Yeah, you and us are the perfect storm, really. Sorry.
Yeah. No, I think this conversation, it went differently to what I expected, because I think you have been broadly misunderstood or misrepresented with your message about lectins. I was sort of gearing up for a debate. Don't apologize. It's refreshing to hear a lot of what you've just shared with us. And I'm really happy that we've had this conversation, and maybe I can be a small part of giving people some more clarity that have tried to misrepresent you or however they go about it. But no, this has been great. I'm curious, for anybody that is interested in any of your books, now that they know what they should be reading when they read it, is where can they find you online? Where can they find the books?
Well, so there's the Dr. Gundry podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. I have two YouTube channels. The GundryMD.com is my supplement and food company. DrGundry.com is my website. And if I, at least in the United States, don't pop up while you're scrolling through your internet, I've done something wrong in marketing. But
fantastic. Well, I'll put all of those links down in the show notes below for everybody so they can scroll down, jump into your world. And before we wrap up, what is one piece of health information from all of the amazing stuff that you know that you wish more people knew about?
Well, where we started, I think if people knew how important vitamin D was. And just to say one thing, so our gut wall is damaged constantly. We have stem cells in our gut wall that are willing and able to turn into a new gut wall cell. But what's fascinating is they have to be pushed into action by vitamin D. And if you don't have enough vitamin D, they just sit there and twiddle their thumbs and say, what do you want me to do? And that's been one of the real revelations for me. The other thing that's exciting is the higher your vitamin D, the more diverse your gut microbiome is. So we just came around right back to vitamin D. So if there's one takeaway, number one, do not be afraid of vitamin D.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for being on the show. This has been incredible. And maybe we'll get you back in the future with the next book.
All right. Yeah, I'm just starting to write the next book, which is going to be really interesting, I assure you, on almost a totally different subject. So it'll be fun.
Amazing. Well, thanks for being here, and we'll see you soon.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Bye. Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learned anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast. Simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember, too, that what works for one person may not work for another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.